Okay, thank you, Raf, for the Cohen picker. Raf decided that instead of me looking up Cohens and what Cohens to do, he's going to build this little Cohen picker. So it's a little app. So I just press a button and boom, there comes a Cohen, and this is what I'm going to the teacher with. So this is the one. This is Raf's Cohen. But what happened was when I looked at it. I thought, I've done this before, you know, but then I checked it and I haven't. I'm surprised because this is quite a famous koan and I've never did it before. So thank you, Raf. This is all you're doing. So let me read out the koan. Toku-san carries his bowls or his bowl. One day, Toku-san came down to the hall carrying his bowls. Seppo asked him, "Old master, the bell has not yet rung nor the drum sounded. Where are you going with your bowls?" Toku-san immediately went back to his room. Seppo told this to Ganto, and Ganto said, "Great Toku-san though he is, he has not yet realized the last word." Hearing of this, Toku-san sent his attendant to summon Ganto and asked him, "Don't you approve of this old monk?" Ganto secretly whispered his intention. Toku-san remained silent. Sure enough, the next day when Toku-san ascended the rostrum, his talk was quite different from usual. Ganto went to the front of the Zen hall and, rubbing his hands together, laughed loudly and said, "Wonderful! How happy I am that our old man has realized the last word. From now on, he'll be subject to no one on earth." Then we have Mumon's commentary. "As for the last word, neither Ganto nor Toku-san have ever heard it, even in a dream. When I examine this point, I find they are just puppets on a shelf. The verse. If you grasp the first word, you will realize the last word. The last word and the first word, they are not this one word." So here we have the koan. So apparently Harada Roshi, who was the monk that really started off Zanbo Zen, our lineage, he was a Soto monk. Remember, for those that may not know, I just repeat it. After Harada Yasutani was also a Soto monk. He officially started Zanbo Zen. In other words, he incorporated the Zanbo Zen school. And then Kōen Yamada, and then also Ryan Roshi, the present abbot, became successors, if you like, and became abbots of this lineage. But Harada, sorry, there was Kubota Roshi as well in between. But Harada apparently said that this is the most difficult, according to him, this is the most difficult koan to get in the entire Momonkan collection. Okay, so you know, hearing something like that, it makes you really look at it more intensely. You know, okay, well, that's, you know, why is that so difficult? Okay, of course, the reason it is difficult is because of the Dharma. You know, and meaning that it's difficult because it's difficult to see the Dharma. You know, when you look at why do we practice koans, or why do we do this practice, you know, especially koan practice, sometimes we need to remind ourselves of the most basic fundamental reason. You know? And the reason, of course, you know, we always talk about we need to transcend duality and we need to see the Dharma, we talk about these things. But why do we even want to transcend duality? You know, what's the big deal? We're living in a dual world, you know, why do we even want to do that? Why do we study koans? What practical reason is there to have Kensho and then to do this koan work? This koan points to that in a very, very subtle way. So what reason do we do koan work? And the reason is very simple. The reason is to overcome our suffering. That is it. So when we look at koans, you know, we've got to somehow link that to something that doesn't gel. If we don't, then it's just, it can easily become an intellectual or a spiritual exercise that has got no relevance. In order to really penetrate a koan, you need to have a certain state of mind. And that state of mind, you know, and of course we have many states of mind, you know, but a really truly, you know, Zen state of mind, if you like, I hate to say that, the Zen state of mind. Nowadays there's so much ads about the Zen meditation and all this sort of thing. But in order to get this state of mind that is utterly free, you know, when we get that type of state of mind, then of course we are free of suffering. So this koan invites us to really penetrate a certain state of mind. But before we get into the koan, I'd like to talk a little bit more about this. And because having a state of mind, like I said just before, you know, we all have always a state of mind. But what state of mind is it that we really wanna inhabit or somehow attain or somehow able to go to? That is always the question. And every single koan invites us to inhabit a certain state of mind. If we find a koan challenging, it's because we haven't got that state of mind. We are not there at that moment. And you may find yourself that, like certainly doing sessions, you know, as I keep on saying, you know, we have got a heightened awareness because we're meditating a lot. And when we are there, then all of a sudden koans bring up much more depth. Okay, it's not that there's more depth in the koan. It is depth in us. We are the ones that are all of a sudden accessing a state of mind where we can see much more than we've seen before. And coming back to the suffering, you know, the key, of course, is not self, being able to realize not self. If we realize not self, you know, then at the same time, and quite often we forget this, there is no other. And if we suffer, it's usually because of self and other. There's usually, we are attached to ourself. That somehow brings that aspect of suffering into the context of whatever it is. So if I say to you, if I say, Sheila, you're a tree. Well, no, I'm not. But if I all of a sudden say, James, you're a pig, or if I say, you're wrong, we take it personally. We don't take it necessarily personally if I say, you're a tree. But it's still a word. I'm not a tree and I'm not a pig. But if someone says I'm a pig, you know, I take it personally, and because of that I suffer. It's absolutely ridiculous. So if someone says something to us, and bang, we're triggered, and the next minute we suffer. And that can be the most subtle thing. Even a look, even someone saying something that they don't even mean, we get triggered all the time. So freeing ourselves from that triggering, the only way that we can do that is by inhabiting a certain state of mind where we are no longer triggered. Just like when I'm saying to you, oh, you're a tree, and you say, no, I'm not a tree. That might not trigger you, but another word might be. You know, or depending on who says it, might do it. If our partner says it, or you know, if someone a complete stranger says it, we might not have any relationship with that stranger, it might not affect us. But if someone else says it that we are closer to, it really starts hitting home. You know. So inhabiting a certain state of mind is what it's all about. And koans, in many ways, present us with opportunities to really see if we see it. Do I really see what's there? Do I really see the Dharma? Okay. So that's what it is. In Buddhism, in classical Buddhism, it is said that in order for us to inhabit that state of mind, you know, we need to have gained merit. So I want to just touch on that. Now, merit is the English translation of the word puna. This is a Pali word, or punja in Sanskrit. Okay, don't know why they translated it into merit. Okay, by the way, the definition of merit, according to the etymology dictionary, which is just to let you know, is spiritual credit for good works. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, most of us would not necessarily relate merit to that definition. But when you look at the etymology dictionary, so you can see where that word maybe came from. Okay. If you look at the definition of puna, you know, what does that actually mean? You know, from the Pali, from the Pali dictionary, and there the definition is that which cleanses the mind. That which cleanses the mind. You know, of course, what are we cleansing the mind about or for? You know, we cleanse the mind of defilements, things that are of delusions, you know, things we believe that are not there, because it's always the Dharma, it's all about seeing things as they are. So cleansing the mind is about cleaning it up to such a degree that we're free to see things as they are. If someone says to us, you're a pig, it's just pig. There should not be anything that should disturb us, you know. It's just pig, you know. Someone says you're wrong, it's just wrong. Someone says you're right, it's just right. Yet if someone says you're right, we get elated, and if someone says we're wrong, we get defeated. It's remarkable. Okay. So the degree to which we can be free of all these mind things that are happening, all these defilement, is the degree to which we've gained merit, spiritual credit. Okay, spiritual credit. In other words, the degree to which we have cleaned up our act, the degree to which we've cleaned up our mind and gained wisdom, so that when that happens, if someone does call us a pig, we can laugh instead of getting angry. Just simple, very, very simple. We can just laugh instead of getting angry. So merit, another definition, is that which is necessary condition for spiritual advancement. It's interesting, isn't it? That which is necessary for spiritual advancement. I mean, even the word merit may already push buttons, because we have certain associations with the word, and if they don't fit our worldview, we already... Like, I must admit, when I hear the word merit, it's like, oh, it gets a bit religious here, or it gets a bit Buddhist-y here, you know. That already starts, it starts already, you know, that the flavor of it is already very much conditioned of that word to the way I interpret it. Okay. So being free of that is what merit is really all about. Okay. Now, I'd like to read you out something else that Bhikkhu Bodhi, he's a Theravadan scholar, that he wrote about merit when I did a little bit of research on this, and I like it very much. He wrote, Bhikkhu Bodhi, famous scholar in the Theravadan tradition, he wrote, the tenor of our inner being must be raised to a pitch where it is fit for the reception of some disclosure of truth. The tenor of our inner being must be raised to a pitch where it is fit for the reception of some disclosure of the truth. So that mind fitness comes in. So that, you know, our inner being, we must be fit to hear it. You know, we can only grasp what we are fit to grasp. You know, sometimes we don't hear it. We are not fit to grasp it. We can't see it. And that certainly applies to koans. We go, oh, I don't know, what is this? What is this meant? We are not fit, we are not yet ready to hear it. So again, we can only grasp what we are fit to grasp, and our fitness is largely a function of our character. That's quite incredible. You know, our fitness is a function of our character, according to Bodhi, Bhikkhu Bodhi. The existential comprehension of truth thus becomes a matter of inward worth, of deservedness or merit. So the degree to which we have cleansed our mind, remember merit in the Puna, one of the definition is to cleaning our mind, you know, is inward worth, that there's work that is done to do that, you know, and I get to that in a minute, you know, and that once we've done that work, we deserve to hear the truth. So that comes back to that merit principle. The capacity to comprehend the truth, he says, pertaining to the spiritual order is always proportional to the store and quality of the merit. Okay. Anyway, I thought that was quite an interesting commentary on merit that Bhikkhu Bodhi wrote. I thought I'd share that with you. Of course, you know, when you look at merit nowadays, especially in Buddhist countries, you know, merit in this sense is inward merit. It's something that we need to work on ourselves. But when you look at merit the way it is taught in Buddhist countries quite often, it's changed. The flavor has changed to outward. You know, so it's like you're paying, you know, in many ways monastics, or you're paying Buddhism to gain merit. That's an outward way of looking at it. You do good deeds, that's an outward way of looking at it to some degree, you know, of merit. So this is, you know, there's a complete difference. And so some people, or some traditions, you know, they make merit, they even call it the merit economy. Like some Buddhist countries have a merit economy because it's all based on this. And certainly within a monastery. When I look at the Chinese temple down in Wollongong where I did my studies, there's a real merit economy going on. They couldn't have built all that, you know, $30 million university and a big bridge going over there. That was another, I don't know how many millions, just to connect the two buildings without a merit economy. People believe that if they give money to the monastery, you know, they're going to get into a different realm as far as Buddhism is concerned. Maybe, you know, that's what, relating to karma, that's what they believe. But that is not the original intention of what merit is about. Merit is about us doing the work so we can get closer to a state of mind where we can see things as they are, so we can see the Dharma. That's what merit is about. And the Buddha, actually, he taught classically that there are three ways that we can gain merit, inward merit. Okay. The first way is dana, which is generosity. Okay, generosity, and this is probably where this generosity, it's become an outward generosity. In other words, you give money to a monastery, and you gain merit. That's probably where that comes from. Okay, but generosity, in its truest sense, you know, is getting rid of attachments. So the antidote to attachments that we have is generosity. And that is not just material, you know. That is, you know, again, that is also comes back to our character. If I'm generous, doesn't matter whether I'm generous with my time, if I'm generous, you know, in my being, with my love towards my children or my parents, that is the antidote, you know. That is the antidote to the defilement of being, of having non-attachment. So that is one of them. Okay, the other one is virtue. You know, virtue is the other one, and the other one is meditation, or bhavana, as it's called. So you've got dana, you've got sila, and you've got bhavana. Bhavana is meditation, and these three in combination, they get us to a state of mind that fosters our capacity to be able to see things as they are. So we can say that our suffering, as I said before, is directly linked to our state of mind. And our state of mind is linked to the insights we get. So now coming back to Koan, our state of mind is linked to the whether we can see the Dharma in a Koan, you know. And of course, we need to put effort into it. Someone asked me the other day in Dokusan, you talk about effort. What is involved in effort? Okay. Effort certainly means, you know, making a time to sit. That is certainly effort. But effort, again, classically is taught as the effort to know that you're in la-la land when you're thinking and to know that that's where you are when you should be right here, right now. That's the effort, and that is not easy to do. In other words, when we meditate, our mind should be on mu. If it's not on mu, and if it's about being somewhere else, let's say at home or with our kids or, you know, on holidays or at work, then the effort is required to come back to mooing or come back to our mantra or come back to our breath. That is effort. And that effort translates day to day into when we drive, we drive. When we cook, we cook. When we have a conversation, we have a conversation. Continuously reading our mind through mindfulness, seeing where am I with my mind in my mind state. And if I know if I'm not here right now, whatever I'm doing, I have to put effort in order to get there, in order to come back. That is what effort is. You know. And we need to really put effort into that. But it's at the same time, it's, you know, that is so productive and so beneficial. Because when we are here, when I'm concentrating on whatever it is that I'm doing, even listening right now, the monkey mind is silent. When the monkey mind is silent, I don't suffer. Suffering is gone. You know. So it all connects. It all connects. Okay, let's look at the koan. So, we have three characters. Tokusan. We have Ganto, and we have Seppo. So Tokusan, at this stage, when this koan was recorded, is said to have been 81 years of age. He died at age 83. Okay. Of course, you may remember Tokusan from case 28, also in the Momonkan. This is right at the beginning where, I think Pat gave a teisho on that once, where he was the master of the Diamond Sutra. He was, for all accounts, the most famous Buddhist scholar at the time, in his era. He was born in 800 and something, 800 and I forget now what the date was. So he was a master of the Diamond Sutra, and he heard about this Zen school. Don't know exactly what school he was with before he became a Zen student, where they taught that the Dharma is not about any doctrine. Okay. The Dharma is about seeing things as they are, if you like. And because he was so engaged in scholarly work and engaged in the Dharma as in teaching the Dharma, he wanted to find out who these people were and challenge them with his knowledge. So this is case 28. And he went on his journey to see the Zen master, and he encountered this lady selling cakes. Okay. And he told the lady that he's looking for this master, and he said, I'm a scholar, and I'm the most famous scholar as far as the Diamond Sutra is concerned, and maybe other sutras as well. And the lady challenged him, you may remember that koan, and she said, well, in the Diamond Sutra it says past mind, what was it, past mind cannot be seen, present mind cannot be seen, and future mind cannot be seen, grasped, with what mind are you going to eat this biscuit if you get it? You know, that was the challenge, and he couldn't answer. And she even said, "If you can't answer, I'm not going to sell you a biscuit." So But there was the challenge, and he couldn't answer that, you know. You know, but even, you know, past, present, future, that this, you know, there's no past, there is no present, there is no future. Even to get our own head around that is really challenging, you know. So, you know, how do you grasp it then? Yeah, it's really challenging. So anyway, this then, he then went to see this teacher, and then the story goes that during one encounter with the teacher at night, he went there with a lantern. It was pitch black outside, and the teacher said, "You better take a lantern." He took a lantern, and as he took the lantern and stepped outside, the teacher blew the lantern out, and at that moment, he had an awakening experience. So that was his first major experience, and he was fairly young at that stage. So now here we have Toku-san, 82 years of age, 81 years of age, and apparently he died at 83, so almost, you know, another 2 years left, so quite an old man, fully matured in Zen, okay? Fully matured as a monk, should really say that. Seppo in this koan was a 41-year-old at the time, and he apparently was very diligent. He was a very diligent monk, but he was late in attaining Teisho at 41. So, of course, you got to remember they were monastics, and a lot of them entered the monastery quite early. Then Ganto was one that was very sharp, and he is supposed to have been had experiences very, very early on, and he was a very sharp mind, even though Seppo and Ganto were Dharma brothers, if you like, but they were, one was much sharper than the other in spiritually, as far as wisdom is concerned. So let's start, read the case out again, line by line. So one day, Toku-san came down to the hall carrying his bowls. Seppo asked him, "Old master, the bell has not yet rung, nor the drums sounded. Where are you going with the bowls?" Okay. So that's the first line. And again, please, you need to now really look at the state of mind. Okay. The bell has not yet rung, nor the drum sounded. Where are you going with your bowls? So those of you that have done session, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, there's that dinner bell that goes, and when the dinner bell goes, you know, we have our ritual, you know, or it might be the morning drum when the hand is rung. You know, once you hear the hand three times, you've got 5 minutes before you get back in the zendo. So if you come back early and someone challenges you and says, "Hey, the bell hasn't been rung. Why, you know, where are you going with your cushion, or where are you going with your bowls?" You know, that sort of thing. And, you know, you can already see here when you look at this, Seppo asked him, you know, "Old master, the bell has not yet rung, nor the drum sounded. Where are you going with the bowls?" You know, get the flavor here, as in there is a little bit of condescension there. He's got bowl. Where are you going with the bowls? It's almost like a bit of, there's just something not right about it. You know, instead of saying, "Oh, the bell hasn't rung yet. Of course he's got his bowl, but where are you going with the bowl?" There is something there that is just, that smells a little bit. You know, there's something not quite right, you know. And of course, if Seppo would have been sharp, you know, just the question on its own, where are you going with the bowls? Where can he go? Where are you going with the bowls? You! There's a you! There's a me! Where are you going with the bowls? So you need to have that. This is now again where wisdom comes in, and where, you know, where clarity comes in. When you've really let go of not self, you see it, you know. Where are you going with the bowls? If you let go of not self, you know, where can he go? Is he even going? Who's going? You know, This is what a koan is inviting us to penetrate. You know, that's the beauty about koans. Okay. Now, the thing is that when we see it, we can actually no longer be hurt. If someone says, "Where are you going?" It's like someone calling you a pig. If someone says, "Oh, that was not nice. That's a. Why did he say that? What did, you know?" Of course, he sees that I'm late. Whoop de doo, big deal. I'm late. I didn't hear the bell. I didn't hear the bell. I'm going with my bowls to the dining room. You know, but to what degree am I now engaging in that and say, "Oh, I'm the senior monk." You know your place, buddy. You know, don't you speak to me like that. But if you really see it, you know, there's not self, there's non-attachment, there's none of that. It's just, where are you going with your bowels? There's no condescension. There's no, you can see that, you can maybe see where Seppo is at, but that's about it. But there's still that total, there's total peace. It's really nice, you know, it's really nice. So that is, again, every koan, even though it always comes from different perspectives, invites us to go deeper and deeper and deeper. And what's beautiful about this too is that, you know, I see it in a certain way. Someone else sees it in another way. They get even more insights into it. There are so many insights to be had here. You know, it's not about getting a koan. It's about a state of mind. And the purer that state of mind, the more we've let go of all these things that we normally are attached to, the more we see it, you know. So this is where merit comes in again. You know, that field, they call it also the field of merit. The field of merit is the field to which, or the degree to which we have cleaned up our act, you know. That's what this this means, you know. So please appreciate this. The next line. Tokusan, after this happened, Tokusan immediately went back to his room. He just immediately went back to his room. Okay. So, again, this line doesn't really, this line, it's just, you have to make of it what you like. You know, what does this mean? He immediately went. Was he upset? Was he not upset? We need to see into his state of mind, if you like. Yeah. I just got a message here. The battery is running low. So can we just plug this in on the computer? Have you got? Okay. Yes. We just need the. No, once the video is on, it really chews. Where is it? Okay. Can I get some more? Okay, no. Hang on. I'll just do it this way. Where was it?
Oh, just at the top, yeah.
Okay, now we're cooking with rice. Okay, so Tokusan immediately went back to his room. Now Seppo told Ganto, for Seppo then went to Ganto, his Dharma brother, and he told him about what has happened. Like, look at this old monk, you know, he doesn't even know when the bell rings or when it doesn't ring, and he goes in, you know, he's bitching, or he is gossiping, or whatever you like to call it, you know. So he told Ganto. And Ganto immediately said, "Great Tokusan though he is, he has not yet realized the last word." So the last word is like, again, a lovely saying. What's the last word? No, he has not yet realized the last word. The last word, of course, is a description of what this whole thing is all about. What it is that we're actually trying to get. You know, the last word is another word. It's another way of saying the entire existence, or it's another way of saying your essential. He hasn't seen his essential nature yet. You know, he hasn't yet penetrated what this is all about. You know, so this is what Ganto told. Seppo told. This is what Ganto said to Seppo. Great Tokusan Doyes, he has not yet realized the last word. Hearing of this, of course, monasteries are like any human, you know, people talk, and so of course Tokusan got wind of this, what they were up to. Hearing of this, Tokusan sent his attendant to summon Ganto. So you come to my Tokusan room here. And then ask him, don't you approve of this old monk? Don't you approve of me? Ganto secretly whispered his intention. Okay. So again, this is something that is discussed in the Dokusan room, but he whispered his intention. What's he intending to do? Why did he say that? You know, what is it? What's behind him saying that? It can be seen as being a really rude remark, but really, what's behind it? You know. And so he secretly whispered his intention. Tokusan remained silent. Silence, by the way, when you hear silence in Zen, it can mean many things. But again, it's our state of mind, which you've got. There's no right or wrong here. No, so when we say, oh, he remained silent, in other words, he didn't know what to say, or he was ignorant of it, or he was flabbergasted, or he was beaten. In other words, in a dialogue, beaten in that sense. Or there's so many nuances about silence. You know, so when you hear the word silent, when someone remained silent, always be aware that it's not necessarily what you think it is. So when Tokusan remained silent, then it continues. Sure enough, the next day when Tokusan ascended the rostrum, his talk was quite different from usual. Ganto went to the front of the Zen hall, rubbing his hands together. Like really, he went in the front of the Zen hall, in front of all the monks, rubbing his hands together. Laughed loudly, like how humiliating, you know, laughed loudly and said, wonderful, wonderful, how happy I am that our old man has realized the last word. Okay, imagine, from now on he'll be subject to no one on earth. Again, this is challenging, you know, why did he do that? What's behind this? You know, this is something again that needs to be penetrated. Of course, there could be many reasons, and we never know, of course, because we weren't there. But that's not the point. The point is our own state of mind. How do we see that? You know, what's behind all of this? You know. Then that's the end of the koan. So in the Dokusan room, that needs to be presented. You know, all these aspects need to be presented. So Mumon gave a commentary, a very interesting commentary. Mumon said, as far as this koan is concerned and as far as this dialogue is concerned, as for the last word, neither Ganto nor Tokusan have ever heard it. They've never heard it, the last word. They're just not there. They've never heard it. Again, penetrate this. They've never heard it. You know, these are great masters. And Mumon, of course, also a great master. They've never heard it. You know, why have they never heard it? Again, it's depending on our merit, depending on our clarity, we can answer that question. When I examine this point, he goes on to say, I find they are just puppets on a shelf. You know, this is also interesting. They're just puppets on a shelf. So, of course, puppets, You know, puppets, someone pulls strings on a puppet. So you could ask yourself, when you look at this sentence, you know, they're just puppets on a, they're just puppets on a shelf. So someone pulls strings on a, I could ask myself, who is pulling my strings? What is still pulling my strings? What is pulling your strings? Okay. What is pulling your strings? What is it that is still, that you still get irked about? Comes back to that suffering, of course, comes back to it. He is saying they're just like puppets on a shelf. You know, it's just, they're just sitting there. No one is pulling their strings. They're just like puppets on a shelf. It's just lovely. It's just if we, you know, if we can be puppets on a shelf, you know. Of course, what really pulls the strings, you know, is cause and effect, you know. Cause and effect pulls the strings, you know. Someone says something and I get upset. Someone says something else and I'm happy. Cause and effect, you know. Transcending cause and effect is when you can sit on the shelf. When you see through cause and effect, you can see it just like puppets on a shelf. It's just a marvelous image, you know. And again, it requires a certain state of mind to see that. And not just to see it, but actually to be like that. It comes back to character, to what Bhikkhu Bodhi said. It's ultimately, it's character, our own character, that gets us to that point. You know, that's what this comes, it comes back to virtue. You know, our own character that gets us to that point. We're no longer muddled up in our thinking. So then we get to the verse. If you grasp the first word, you will realize the last word. So I missed the word last, but anyway, this is what it says. If you grasp the first word, you will realize the last word. It's very simple. If you grasp the first, then you know the last. Okay. And then comes a very challenging statement. The last word and the first word, they are not this one word. It's again, it's like, you know, your mind, of course, plays tricks. And you think, oh, we try and look at that, you know, discursively. What does this mean? You know. So one way of looking at that is if you really see the entire existence and nothing but the entire existence, there cannot be one or two or three. If you're gone, if there is not, if you really see not self, if you're gone, there cannot be one or two or three. You know. If, again, the last word and the first word, they are not this one word. You know, it's even trying to somehow pointing to it. It's, who's there to point? Who points? So again, it's a very, very subtle way of demonstrating of where certainly Mumon wrote this verse, where Mumon is at. But of course, we, the challenge for us, as we present the verse in the Dokusan, is to really penetrate this, to really see that, you know, and show that, that we see that. That's not easy. But the degree to which we see that is the degree to which we've established merit, if you like, cleaned our mind, you know, and it's the degree to which we are free and we stop suffering.